Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
You are the soul.
Hello and welcome to Off the Beaten Track podcast. I'm your host, I'm Stu Whiffin. I hope you're doing well. It's another week, therefore it's another episode. And today's episode is smashing. It took a while to get this one in the diary, which I'm sure we mentioned at the beginning as well. But today's guest is Billy Lunn, frontman of the Subways and all-round absolute gentleman. It was so much fun. I've met Billy before, and I couldn't wait to get him on Off the Beaten Track, and you'll see why when this podcast starts. But before it starts, just want to say hi and thanks to everybody on the Distraction Pieces Network. Big thanks to my producer, 76. And also, if you've explored the Distraction Pieces Network and you found lots of podcasts to listen to there and you've still got room for more, then can I suggest that you head over to www.podbiblemag.com. That's the magazine that me, Scroobius Pip and Adam Richardson have set up at the beginning of 2019, and we're heading into 2020 now. And you can get the magazine when it comes out now. It gets distributed right across England, Ireland, Scotland, Wales in the Sunday Times, and you can read it online, and you can buy copies online, and it's just a one-stop shop for all things podcast. And we have a podcast for that as well. The Pod Bible Podcast is also a weekly podcast hosted by myself, Pip and Adam. And we have all your favourite podcasters on there chatting about their podcast as well as recommending the ones that they like listening to. Right, I think that's it. If you enjoy this episode, please check the back catalogue because there's a bundle of episodes in there featuring people that we talk about today, people like Block Party, people like Billy's wife Rowena, Tim Dello from Transgressive Records. I'm trying to think who else we spoke about on the episode. But go and have a look in the back catalogue because it's absolutely chock-a-block with amazing creatives, whether they be artists, musicians, actors, producers, DJs. Go and get stuck in. And if you see us on the socials, we're on all the usual platforms. Please give us a like, love, a share or a retweet because I love doing this podcast and I hope that you enjoy listening to what the guests have to say. And obviously, you know, my goal is to hopefully get this podcast out to as many people as possible. So all your support is much appreciated. There is a Patreon page as well. Each week I put out a show on there where I play records in full and chat about them and sometimes have guests and sometimes it's just me talking about certain eras or certain genres or just records that you know, I think that you should check out and stuff. So that's over on Patreon. I think I've exhausted all the hyping and the selling business now. So I'm just going to shut up and I'm going to say please enjoy Off the Beaten Track podcast with the wonderful Billy Lunn. I've got an announcement. Save Our Souls Clothing. www.sosclothing.co.uk. Why am I telling you this? Because they're our official sponsor. Yeah, that's right. Go and check them out because their clothing is off the scale. You're going to love it. So they've decided they want to be our sponsor, which is amazing. And what I have to do is I have to tell you about why they're amazing. So here's a little bit of blurb. So they've only been going a year. And they're based in Southend-on-Sea, just up the road from me. They put the company together based on a love of tattoos and alternative music. And they've worked with some of the greatest artists around the world to produce these items of clothing that are as unique as you lot. All of the designs are printed using biodegradable, sustainable and water-based inks. In addition to that, they only print on garments made by members of Fair Wear Foundation. I mean, come on, great clothing and a conscience. Since going live in April last year, they've seen their audience grow massively and are now selling orders all across the world. And they were recognised by Cosmopolitan magazine as one of the best sustainable clothing brands alongside names such as Stella McCartney. I mean, that's quite a first year, right? So go and check them out because they've put a lot of love into supporting this podcast and I couldn't be happier. What else they've done is they've given you 15% off. So if you head over to www.sosclothing.co.uk, do a bit of shopping, see what you like, throw it in the basket, and then on the way out, put in the discount code BEAT15, BEAT15, and that'll save you 15% off. Amazing, right? www.sosclothing.co.uk, official sponsors of Off The Beaten Track podcast. Let's get back to that podcast. It's Off The Beaten Track podcast on the Distraction Pieces Network. With me, Stu Whiffin. Okay, we're recording. We are in we're in Hipster Shoreditch today, and sitting opposite me is my friend Billy Lunn from the Subways.
Hello.
You all right?
Yeah, I'm good.
So we've had a bit of a chinwag before we've pressed record, and it's one of them things where you don't want to say too much.
I know.
Especially when you start talking music, because you want to kind of make sure we have the chat on here.
I can see your eyes going, nah, stop talking, save it. But I'm terrible. Like, I just yabber on.
Yeah. Well, we should say that we met probably a year and a half ago when you come and done the Hardcore Listening podcast.
Yes.
Which has gone down in history as one of the most surreal we've ever done. And we've done a lot of batshit podcasts.
Oh, nice.
But the fact that you went into pretty much every character in the Life of Brian series.
Yeah, I'm so obsessed with that film. Like, if I start talking about it, and me, my dad and my brother are all the same, like, we go into the voices.
And obviously since then, I've done many a show on Boogaloo Radio, which you've got a show on that you do with Rowena. Obviously, Rowena's come and done, Rowena being your wife, has done Off The Beaten Track as well. And so it's nice to finally get you sitting in front of me talking about music on Off The Beaten Track.
Well, it's good to be here, man. Like, I'm so sorry I haven't been here, you know, thus far. But like,
mate, you've been busy.
I know. Yeah, I've been, like, doing essays and stuff, so yeah.
And I see there's lots of good stuff coming up, so yes. We'll talk about that as we move through this podcast. But, Billy, I always start with the song with the greatest ever intro.
Yes, okay. So, for me, it's Sabotage by Beastie Boys. And, like, I felt so standard when I put this down, but for me, it's like the perfect intro. And you know, growing up on rock and roll, it's kind of, the sense of the ramshackle and craziness and, the confluence of maybe like, several genres has always really appealed to me. So the first time I heard this intro, I was like, okay, how do they do this?
Yeah.
And I still struggle to play it on guitar. Like, it's so simple. It's two notes.
Is it?
It's like, yeah, I've worked it out. It's like it's G sharp, and then it's like an F sharp, which is only just below it, but they play it an octave above on a different string. And it's beautiful. It's so beautiful. And there's something so punk about it. There's something so jazzy about it. There's something so rock, and the rhythm of it as well is like, it speaks of the melting pot of outer New York, you know, but at the same time, it always felt like it was mine and ours and everyone else's, you know, because it's so free. I think that's what it sort of, elicits from me, is like a defiance. Every time I hear that opening riff, I'm just like, I can do this. I can do today. And like, screw everyone. Yeah.
I will watch them doing that on Letterman every couple of weeks.
Do you know what? Like when I first started uni in 2016, and I was having a really, I was struggling to get started, and you have to live in college when you go to Cambridge. So, you know, you wake up, you'll go to breakfast, and it's so archaic, it's ridiculous. So like every morning on a Monday, I'd post that Letterman performance on the Wolfson College Facebook page.
Really?
Like, everybody, we can do this.
Amazing.
Yeah, that Letterman performance. And sometimes Josh and I, when we're on tour, we'll be in the dressing room, we'll turn around and go, should we play the Letterman performance? And we're like, yeah, go on then. And we just put it up on YouTube.
It's so good to know that other people get as hyped about that.
It's magnificent. Yeah. There's something about it, right? They've got a jazz bassist playing it. And you know, they're all playing their instruments, and there's something multi-genric about it. Mm. and defiant as well, like I've said about the performance. It's together, it's so together.
Yeah.
It's so locked in the same way that like jazz music is locked in, but then it's kind of like punk in the way that Beastie Boys have always been.
Yeah.
And you know, hip hop as well. They've always been that kind of like that meshing of those two genres. So it's everything that I kind of love about music. But it's that G sharp and that F sharp specifically, and with that really kind of overdriven sound as well.
Yeah,
that's just like it perks my ears up and it makes me feel ready for anything.
Okay, well, I guess a lot of people's entry point into knowing the Subways.
Yeah.
Will be Rock and Roll Queen.
Right, yeah.
And, I mean, that's quite an intro.
Oh, cool, yeah.
Right. So where I'm going with this is, I know that you've been working on, we spoke before, and we will talk about it more, you've been working on new music.
Yeah.
When you first started out as a Subways, you were very young.
Yeah, yeah, ridiculously young. I look back now and I'm like, how? How did I do all that?
How did you approach writing intros, and how much emphasis did you put on the intro, and how is that today?
Right. Back when we first
started. Do you get
started,
where I'm going with that?
Yeah, totally. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Like, it was, I suppose, like, I knew of the importance of intros. Like, you know, I grew up and I remember hearing Smells Like Teen Spirit and that intro. And you know, My Hero by Foo Fighters, the drum intro. I think a part of it also was like, I was just really anxious to get the song started.
Yeah.
So you listen to songs like Oh Yeah, and it's just like, I think it's four bars or two bars of the do, 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 do. I even wanted to cut that in half because I was like, let's just get the song started. Let's get straight to the chorus.
Was that just for your peace of mind, or was you considering radio and were them things ever come into your mindset?
Radio never really came into my mindset until we started recording the album, and our A&R guy would come in and go, oh, you don't want to scream because of radio. And I was like, what is so important about radio?
Yeah.
We're probably never going to get played on radio, so don't worry about it.
Yeah.
No, it was all about playing live. I think like when we were on, we started out primarily as like a live band. We formed so that we could play at the Square in Harlow.
Cool.
Like, which unfortunately now is like reduced to rubble. Because it was sold off by a Tory council to some investors who still haven't built what they were meant to be investing in. I just think the council just wanted that place shut down. But, you know, it was full of history.
And I want to talk about that. Well, let's do it now. Let's talk about the Square.
The Square, yeah. So, like, we formed the band because of the Square. Like, we were in school. We would rehearse after school in, like, the music block. And luckily, you know...
I feel what we should say, for those that are unaware of what the Harlow Square was, it wasn't, I guess, a kind of club as you may sort of expect to see on a high street. It was almost like a youth centre as well, wasn't it?
Yeah, totally.
Yeah, and so you could, I think you could go in there at maybe under 18, if I remember rightly. Was it 16 plus? And
yeah, they'd have days on the weekends and in holidays, school holidays, where they'd run rock school. And they'd get kids in and just teach them how to play instruments. And you'd by the end of the weekend, you'd be in a band and you'd be performing a cover on stage, and they'd film it and record it for you, and you'd go away with like this artifact of your performance, and you'd feel like
you've done something. That?
Honestly, man, like it's life changing. And the fact that so many kids are going to be deprived of that in Harlow and everywhere. We weren't even from Essex or Harlow. Yeah. We were from Hertfordshire, but we travelled all the way up because we knew how important and great that place was. But we formed so that we could play in the rock contest, and we did that like 3 years running. And by the time we did the third year, we were the Subways, and we were about to start playing gigs in London. And then, you know, we spent 2 or 3 years playing London, and then we were eventually signed. But like, we wouldn't be a band whatsoever without the Square.
Yeah.
I mean, we would play a show, and afterwards the people at the Square, who are still our friends and our mentors, they come up and go, "That was good. You know, you're trying to do this. You're trying to be that, you know, find you." And, you know, they deconstruct you.
Yeah.
And it was like a real learning experience. So, it was essential. And I met Ro there as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, amazing.
Yeah, Chikinki gig.
Chikinki.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. That's a word I've not heard for a long time. I'm sure Ro talks about that on the episode,
I think she thinks it was a mohair gig, I think. And I'm like, no, it was Chikinki.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, we shouldn't overlook the importance of Harlow Square. And as someone that, you know, has worked in an Essex music venue for,
right.
for just starting my fourth decade, yes. When we would play, Chinneries. Or at the time, it was the Esplanade in Southend.
Played Chinneries with Ordinary Boys and Hardfire.
Amazing.
Yeah, it was like this seaside tour around all these places, and we played Chinneries. I loved it.
And that was, that, you know, you'd play there, and then one of them Essex venues, you'd play the White Club or the Army and Navy in Chelmsford, and then you would go and play the Square in Harlow. And it was just an essential part of forming your band and developing yourself as a band. You know, you could get people to them gigs because we was based in Essex. It wasn't too tough to get people along to them shows. And it's such a shame that so many of them venues that I've just mentioned there, the Esplanade, the Wire Club, the Army and Navy and the Square, they're no longer here.
I know. It's like, there were several acoustic performances I did before the Square shut down. And there would be like, it would stagger.
There was a lot of sort of stuff put in place to try and stop it, wasn't there?
Definitely.
There was lots of benefit stuff going on.
So like, one of my best mates actually invested in it, and he created Square One, which took responsibility from the council. So he was saying like, we'll take over, we'll do this, because this means that much to us that we want to keep it running. So just go away, leave it to us. We'll put our own money and our own resources into it. And they did for a while. But obviously they didn't own the venue. And I was like, I was so close to just going, how much does it cost? I'll see if I can pile the money together and I'll live upstairs or something, you know, because I would do that for that place, but it was never going to happen. Because, you know, that they always had this idea that they were going to demolish it and have someone buy the land and build luxury flats. And that's unfortunate. You know, it's happening everywhere now. They're just demolishing all these hubs of creativity and these like these places of these relics of like musical history, and then it's turning them into, I don't know, stuff for men in suits to
absolutely
to make capital on.
We're recording this in WeWork in East London, which is pretty like much exactly that.
Yeah, I say that having just walked into the building and gone, oh, this is lovely, isn't it? this is like the modern quandary.
Oh, but as you were saying that, I was thinking, yeah, shit, that's exactly where we are right now, and it was the epitome
but
of it.
I was walking over, like I was walking over, and I'm like, I'm a sucker for this, and I saw a bridge, and I saw a derelict building, then I saw a train line, then I saw this glass building, and I had to take a picture of it, and the title I put alongside it was like a confluence of the derelict and the new.
Yeah.
Like, and I love that stuff, but at the same time it just creates this weird tension in me that's like, God, we're going in such a weird direction where we have to we have to equalize within ourselves, like this idea that we want to keep things the same and we want to keep the important stuff, but then like it's so out of our control, we just have to run with it.
Yeah.
You know? And it, I suppose in a way, in a weird paradoxical way, it's making kids all over the country you know, they're not going to the venues. They're going to the bigger venues. They're going to these, like, corporate venues, and they're going to the corporate festivals. But even they're kind of, like, splintering up, and you get in the smaller festivals and more family-orientated festivals and the kind of indie festivals. But, you know, music will persevere. And it's like, it's not me, like, conceding to this Tory mindset that, you know, regardless of what happens, people will be creative and innovative or whatever, because I hate Tories and I hate that mindset. I think we should provide services for people to flourish.
Absolutely.
But music is, like, it's... And I go on to explain this in like the next one, I think. But like music, we have these emotional and intellectual connections with music that force us to do something about it, I suppose. And, you know, when we couldn't afford to rent out a room in the square or like record in the square, because when you get to a certain point, they'd be like, right, OK, you're going to pay for an engineer to turn up and record you and use our mics and use our desk and we'll mix it for you and all that sort of stuff. And even when we were still like building up our money store so that we could go in and actually record in the square, we were recording on a Digi 8 track at home in our parents' council house, so that we could just have something to put up online and try and get gigs.
Yeah.
So, you know, and you got music technology that sort of affords that now. But even that's kind of expensive. But like with stuff like Reaper and I don't know, even Audacity, I suppose you can get something down.
Yeah,
you know, that maybe like plants a seed.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's just such a shame because there was something so almost like ceremonial about, in the same way that like clubbing and raving was ceremonial and community based. You know, there's and with the what was it, the Criminal Justice Act that like stopped all those raves, that was bringing people together and possibly could have led to this, like,
couldn't control it, Billy. They couldn't
it scares them.
Right, best stop that.
Yeah, it scares them
and the riots at the Criminal Justice Act, I mean,
yeah.
I can vividly remember the guy that I was co-promoting with at the time literally being yanked off of these gates on the news, and it was unbelievable what they put in place, you know, all of a sudden. However much there was, you know, ecstasy involved, whatever you want to say, there was people being nice to each other
en
masse,
yeah,
celebrating stuff that had been created in bedrooms, that had been created in little dirty studios, and it exploded,
yeah,
this huge ball of culture. And what I would love to have seen was where that could have gone.
I know.
How that could have flourished to something else.
This is it. The higher echelons, the people in power that get scared, all they're essentially scared of is like people being good and nice to each other and realizing that they have the power to change themselves and society. Don't like it.
Mm.
So, you know, they shut down. And what's happened recently with live venues and like even something as insidious as like cutting funding for the arts and, you know, making sure that councils don't have enough money so that community centres like the Square can just keep going. That's like a more peaceable but at the same time a dangerous way of taking autonomy away from people,
mm-hmm,
and the opportunity to express, you know. So yeah, there's a real sadness that kind of like lives within me since the death of the Square. And my best mate tries as much as he can to kind of like do these like benefit nights, and which I try and do as much as possible, but it just breaks my heart being in a room with the same people that I grew up with and that I learned so much from. But we're not at the Square, we're somewhere else. And it's like, I feel adrift,
yeah,
you know, like a refugee or an exile or something. And you know, a part of me is like, you know, I really want to, I want my band to do well so that I can maybe, I don't know, buy out the investors and do something about
it.
But yeah, we'll see. We'll see.
That's the longest answer we've ever done for question one.
I'm so sorry.
Mate, I'm loving it. Track two, Billy.
Yes.
The first song that you remember hearing that had an emotional impact on you.
Yeah, right. So it's The Track to My Tears by Smokey Robinson and the Miracles. And it's remained, since I first heard it, my all-time favourite song, and it will never, ever be trumped. God, I feel bad even just saying that word as a verb. it's up until I heard that song, and I was like 6 years old when I first heard it. And,
where was that?
It was in the car on the way to swimming lessons at Hatfield, which is where I first my first memories are of growing up in Hatfield, or as I like to fondly call it, Shatfield, because it was a bit of a shithole.
Yeah.
But you know, I my heart is in that shithole. I up until that point, I would, you know, we'd go to the old Trades and Labour Club on the weekends and we'd do dance and they'd play like the disco classics. And I just loved to dance. Like, I'd be the first and the last on the dance floor. And my mum would love it. She'd be laughing.
Did you show off?
I was such a show off. we'll come, when we come to the club in one, like, I'll show you how much of a show off I was. But I would try dragging people up onto the dance floor because I love to move.
Yeah.
I just loved the beat, I loved the rhythm, and I loved the place I went to when I was dancing. But when I listened to Smokey Robinson and the Miracles, the Tracks of My Tears, it became more than just rhythm and like a means to dancing on a dance floor. It suddenly became, I like there was this emotional connection that was forged. And I was like, what is it that could make someone feel so impassioned and so yearning, and at the same time make the listener so impassioned and so yearning? It's love, isn't it? Mm. He's speaking about love. And that's how I learned about love. Like, and every relationship I've had, unrequited or successful or painful or whatever, has its origins in that song. And like the ineffability of love as well. Like, there's something great about Smokey Robinson and the Miracle music, in that it's so simple, and Smokey's lyrics are so seemingly simple. I mean, Bob Dylan once called him the greatest American poet, which I think is going a bit too far.
Yeah,
let's put Walt Whitman somewhere there.
Yeah.
he does something so well about talking about how difficult it is to express by expressing. It is like poetry. And after that point, I knew how to love, I suppose. It was just so weird.
Yeah.
So like those connecting fibers between music and love are like unendingly intertwined in me now.
Yeah.
You know, so whenever I write a song, I have to try my very best not to make it a love song. So much. Like, every song is like, oh, how can I write about love? How can I write about a girl or a boy I fancy? Or like, you know, and after a while I'm like, no, I can make this about, I'll make this about this instead. Yeah. But it always starts off with like, how can I explain, you know? What can I say?
Do you know what? The first album that... not the first time I ever bought, but the first time it was ever on in my house was it was called Motown Chartbusters.
Oh, you can't go wrong.
And you can't, but it had Tracks of My Tears and Tears of a Clown on it.
Tears of a Clown.
So it had both on there. And I remember, and as much as since then, obviously I've explored that sort of music, you know, Motown and Marvin and everybody so much. I remember hearing them two tracks and saying, have you got any more records to my parents from Smokey Robinson and Miracles? And they had this like box of 7-inch singles, and then they pulled out You Really Got Hold of Me.
Oh.
And then I was like, yeah. What? Oh, fuck.
What is
and
this?
Like, and then I just remember I was probably about 10, and I'm maybe a little bit older than that, when the Oliver Stone film Platoon came out.
Right.
And on the trailer, they used Tracks of My Tears.
Yeah.
And I remember it just reignited it in me again.
Yeah.
And it's an absolutely incredible record, and yeah. It's so evocative, and it's. I couldn't pick a better one myself, mate.
Ah, oh, cool. Well, one of the things that I really love about this song, and I think that like I know where the cracks in the transfer are on the analog tape, like because I know this song so much, right. I've played it so many times, I know when it's going to cut out in certain points. On you know, I've got so many sort of transfers of it. Like I've got from a compilation over here, which I know is like 958. Kilobytes per second and all that sort of stuff, because it's it's imprinted on my soul, and yeah. I have to know every version of it.
Yeah.
It's something I can't let go of, and that's why I had to get it tattooed on me.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I've got like this lozenge microphone because I saw this live performance, and it's got like in the bottom there. I'm going to get it redone because it's had too much exposure in the sun from like Big Day Out Festival and that sort of stuff. But what was I going to say? I've forgotten what I was going to say.
You watched a performance
of it. Yes, I did. Yeah, sorry. I got the lozenge microphone because I saw a performance of it, and I bought... This is so terrible. This is just so me. I bought my mum a Smokey Robinson and the Miracles DVD, and it has like all the recordings and then all the recordings a cappella, and you've got to listen to like Tracks of My Tears a cappella, and you can hear the music through the cans. It's just coming down the microphone. It's glorious. But there's this live performance of him singing Tracks My Tears, and then actually You Really Got a Hold on Me, and he's kind of losing his voice, and it's just
a recent performance where he's losing his voice.
It's in the 60s, and it must have been one of those Motown tours that they did around the country. It's like, hey, I've got this new single, You Really Got a Hold on Me, and I'm gonna sing it for you now, and everyone's like screaming. But there's something inherently emotional about Motown music that I think is like rooted in pain and disenfranchisement and marginalization, where love and speaking about love became like a coded kind of language of the pain that they were going through as a community. And, you know, which is why Hitsville was so essential, because it was a place where they could come together and be autonomous and be creative and expressive and free. And, you know, they ruled the charts from this little house it was Michigan, wasn't it? So, you know, I think that's why Motown music is so expansive, because underlying all of it, and, you know, as a white guy in England, you know, I was working class and grew up on a council estate, but, you know, we all have our own small problems, micro problems. Some of us have our bigger problems, are much more substantial and like socially based problems. But I think that's what's so incredible about Motown music, is that and why this song touched me, is because it has this unconscious, unspoken, sublime way of just sort of penetrating through the intellectual and grabbing hold of your heart and squeezing.
And there's so much tragedy in them songs, yet the music's so joyous,
isn't
as
it?
Well.
That's it's what's like, so crazy about it. You listen to Tracks of My Tears, and if it didn't have the lyrics, if it didn't have the, even if it didn't have the melody and it just played through, you'd be like, what a lovely little melody.
Yeah.
What a lovely little sort of chord sequence. What a happy little song.
Yeah.
But he's, and because of like the delicacy of his voice and its high register, he's pained.
Yeah.
But I like that. Oh my God, I've never thought of this before. That's kind of what I do. I sort of take rock music and I turn them into painful love songs.
There you go. You've got your answer.
I realized Rock and Roll Queen is about unrequited love, but it's like a really rocky, happy song.
Brilliant.
I suppose it's kind of...
Should
like,
anyone else want off the beaten track therapy, just reach out to me.
Come to East London for free. Coffee supplied.
Hello. I've interrupted the podcast again, haven't I? Sorry, it won't take a sec. All I want to say is, the songs that we're talking about in this podcast, if we can't play them, it's just because of the regulations regarding playing licensed music.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need.
Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
And such. So if you want to hear the songs, just go over to Spotify and search Off the Beat and Track Podcast, and you can listen to all the songs because I've put playlists up for each of these. If you can't find it on there, I'll send links on all the social media accompanying each episode. So you've just got to press that one button and you can go through and you can enjoy all the songs that our guest picks. Anyway, I'll shut up, get back to the podcast. See you on the other side. Okay. Billy, I want you to tell me for track three, the song reminds you of your time at school.
Right. Okay. So, I went to an all boys school, in Hartford, called Richard Hale, and it was great. It was wonderful. I had a good group of friends. I didn't have like one group of friends. I was one of those kind of kids that bounced around from group to group. I'd hang with the popular crew and then I'd hang with the rock crew and, you know, and then I'd hang with sort of like the, I don't know, the sporty crew or whatever. But I was never quite in with people. And, but one thing that united all of those groups was the garage movement. UK garage. And
is this secondary school?
This is secondary school, right. Yeah. So I was in school 96 to 2001.
Okay.
I remember hearing Sweet Like Chocolate, and I don't remember where I was, but all I remember is this overarching memory of just all the brilliant times in school. And all the, I kind of remember that it was never really about learning. Like, I was always in the middle set. So always set three or set two. I was never one or five.
Yeah.
So I was kind of like, you know, I'd turn up and I'd do the work. But for me, school was like, okay, when can I go to the music block and tinker on the piano? Or, right, are we going on the field to play football today? And
yeah.
And as much as I was like, I was bullied for being gay, and I'm not, I'm bi, but I couldn't quite explain it or even like understand it at that point in my life. But I was like, from year 8, 9 onwards, even the year 7s would be like, oh, you're fucking gay, you know, in the hallways. And I'd be like, by the time I got to year 11, I was just so used to it. But the thing,
used to it, but does that mean it would water off a duck's back or would it?
No, it really hurt.
Yeah, of
it
course.
It really hurt.
That's like a lot for a young person to be able to get their head around.
It was so weird because I grew up in a household that was like, you know, it's totally okay to be gay. And even my mum, like a couple of months ago, we sat down and my mum's been going through her own troubles recently. And we've been having a lot of coffee mornings together, just chatting, and I'll be playing her some new stuff, been writing in the studio. And she'd go, Billy, I've just remembered, we all thought you were gay. I was like, so did everyone else. So my family did too. But no, it's much more complicated than that. And but I like, even so, I still got on with everyone.
Did that spoil school?
Sorry?
Did that spoil school for you? So I normally ask people if they enjoyed school.
Yeah, like it's so riddled with conflict for me because like I loved certain teachers, I feared certain teachers, I loathed certain teachers, and that was the same with students. You know, there were people that I loved, I was scared of, that I just didn't want to give the time of day to, and. As far as I'm concerned, like that's just kind of school, isn't it? Like it's like this microcosm of society where you know, you live within school, a more compressed and more intense and concentrated experience of what it is to be in the outside world. And then you get outside and you're like, actually, things aren't as intense as they are when you're in school, because you spend so much time with like a small group of people amongst like a much larger group of people. And it kind of is like that, but it's not at all. And especially if you're going to go into something like music, which I did, which frees you from the 9-to-5 quotidian experience of sitting down at a computer next to someone you sit down to next to every day. I promised myself when I was 16 that I was never going to do that. I was like, even if I work in a hotel collecting dirty sheets from hotel rooms, which I ended up doing. I was like, that. I don't want to do that. And my mum was like, okay, we're going to get you on the council house waiting list and we're going to get you a job. And I was like, no.
What did you want to be at school?
I wanted to be like a truck driver, you know? Because I like...
I honestly,
this is so weird. You know what's really funny is that I don't even have a driving license. Brilliant. I've never driven a car.
That's a good start.
But I have flown a plane.
Really?
Yeah. I went for one plane lesson for my birthday because my dad knows I'm obsessed with planes and trains and all that like geeky shit. But I've never driven, never had a lesson, like, you know, and I'm 35 now.
Right.
I'm going to. Yeah. I will. Just not.
No rush, mate.
Yeah. You know, I quite like being driven around. That's the thing. Like, since I was 19, 20, I've been on tour buses and I'm kind of like, well, I'm getting used to this now.
Of course, mate.
So, you know, I paid for Ro to do her driving lesson because she was really keen. She, you know, she really wanted to be independent and go and get a job. And I was like, I'll tell you what, I'll do your driving license. I'll pay for the car. And then it's yours. But, you know, if I need picking up from the studio,
yeah,
that would be lovely. Thank you. And that is the way.
That's a good deal. That's a good deal.
So.
Was you playing music at school?
I heard Supersonic by Oasis, and from that moment I was like, I'm learning to play the guitar. And from that day onwards, I would wake up every single day and I would be like, right, what can I learn to play today? Or, you know, yeah, what riff can I make up today? I was obsessed, absolutely obsessed. So in school, yeah, I there reached a point where I'd sort of moved from sport and moving around in social groups. I took my GCSE in music, and I was spent most of my time in the music block. And that's where, you know, Josh and I started playing. I taught Josh the drums to Supersonic, and, you know, we play together, and we've been playing together ever since. I started dating Charlotte after we met at Harlow Penguins Swimming Club. I used to be a national swimmer, so I saw Charlotte in a swimming costume, and I was like, yep, I would like to go on a date with you, please. And yeah, you know, as soon as Charlotte started hanging out with me and Josh, I was like, fancy playing bass guitar? And that's it. Charlotte would come from her school over in Sawbridgeworth, which I'll mention a bit later. She'd come to Hartford and I'd book a room for us to just cover Nirvana and Smashing Pumpkins and Green Day and then eventually making our own songs.
Wonderful. Yeah. Well, I want to talk about that. We're going to the next song, but then I do want to talk about the formation and the next steps, because I had Tim Deller on here.
Okay.
And I didn't realise that you were his first signing, weren't you?
Yeah, absolutely.
And, and
so much love for those guys. Honestly, my heart swells every time I think of them. I remember when we first met them. We first met them at a Wetherspoons in Highbury.
Wicked.
it was so funny. They were so.
This is we're talking about Transgressive Records.
Yeah, Transgressive Records. So sorry, but they were like us. Like we were 17 or 18 at the time.
He couldn't have been much older.
No, he wasn't. He wasn't. Right. Like they were exactly the same. They were like these two young, precocious, intelligent, honest, really go-getting guys, and just so lovely. Like so lovely. And you know, I remember when we first met, and they'd sort of like. They'd done a few things, like they talked to Block Party and they talked to the Rakes, and they're like, oh, we're so glad to be working with a, like, you know, good looking bunch of people. And we're like, oh, they're our friends. What are you talking about? It was so funny. Like they were just, they were, they were, they were, they were just such a joy to work with, in that they were just like us. They were all over the place. You know,
well, let's pick up on that.
New, you know, always going in new directions, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think they've done all right as well now, haven't they?
They've done pretty well. but this is what they are. They were always going to be something.
Yeah.
Because they cared and they love music and they love people and they love putting those two things together. Yeah. You know. But like, I just want to go back to like garage music, because garage music was a huge part of my growing up.
Yeah.
Like, I was, you know, I grew up on like AC/DC, Deep Purple, T-Rex, Bowie, Ramones.
Oh, there's a lot of music on at home then.
Yeah. Mum and dad was a huge rocker. Our first ever gig that we went to was AC/DC at Wembley Stadium.
Wow.
And then like 10 years later we were supporting them. No, was it 10 years? Yeah, it would have been 10 or 11 years afterwards.
I mean, how was that? To be able to go from that, you know, that gig with your dad. Yeah. Did your dad come to the show?
Oh, dad's been our drum tech.
Amazing.
Yeah, yeah. We you know, we were kids when we first started. When we were like, yeah, we're going to start booking gigs in London. Dad had just been made redundant because he grew up in Wales, like in the hills, mountains in Wales, in Nantyglo, Miglamorgan. And he was severely dyslexic. Like, he couldn't read or write when he met my mum at 23. She taught him to read and write. And he managed to get a job as a miller and a turner and an engineer in Welwyn Garden City in a factory. And I don't know what happened with the company, but my dad was made redundant because of his lack of qualifications, couldn't get a job. He was sort of just, he was kind of like, It was horrible. It was like a really bad period, and that's why like I'm ever thankful for a Labour government, because without them we never would have got through those mm-hmm. times. I'm so sorry I'm being so partisan. But,
not at all.
So when we first started gigging in London, I was like, okay, I'm making a little bit of money doing my job at the hotel, so I'll pay Dad 10 quid to drive us into London. Dad drove us into London and he'd help set us up. We'd play the gig. He'd help us set down and then we'd drive home. And Mum eventually would be at the back of the room selling our CDs and any wares that we had.
Love it.
And when we played our first gig at the Astoria headlining, you know, Dad was still there and Mum was really upset actually, because the merch area is in the bar at the Astoria. It wasn't in the main room.
Of course.
So our first big gig at the Astoria, Mum couldn't watch us. She's man in the stand.
Amazing.
I know. But yeah, eventually Mum was like, I can't do this anymore, boys. I'm going to have to stop. But Dad was, you know, Dad, I remember growing up, and this is before I even wanted to play the guitar, just strumming away on an acoustic. And he was self-taught, you know. He taught me my first E chord. My first guitar after I heard Supersonic, he picked up from my nan's. She had a lodger. And he'd sort of skipped town without paying, but he'd left behind this ratty old acoustic with no strings. And my nanny Dorian was like, what am I going to do with it? You know, that's how she spoke. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
And that's how my mum speaks as well. And my dad was like, oh, I'll come pick it up.
That's very similar to your Brian's mum voice.
It is very, isn't it? It's like, I know. I do have a habit of caricaturing people to Life of Brian. What's he like? You're fucking nicked. That's every copper. So yeah, dad strung it, tuned it, showed me my first E chord, and that was it. I was teaching myself. But yeah,
garage music.
There we go. I'm sorry. I'm like Tristram Shandy over here.
Oh, I'm loving it.
I regress. Digress. Sorry. It was one of the first kind of ventures for me into music that wasn't played like viscerally with the fingers and hands, you know, that it was by people, you know, done by people in their bedrooms with like software.
Mm.
And which is amazing because, you know, I was so absolutist at that point. I was like, oh, there's no music worth listening to unless it's got guitars in.
Sure.
And then like Sweet Like Chocolate came out and I was absolute, like it was like hearing ABBA for the first time. I was like, can music really do this? Can it like exist with just a beat and then like this really simplistic melody over the top and reach number one and permeate the consciousness of like every single person on this country. And yeah, it was true. And it was another one of those moments where your perspective is completely broadened, and you're thankful and liberated for it. But yeah, it was, and I'm an unashamed lover of garage music. I don't care who knows it.
Absolutely. Track four.
Right,
the
yes.
The first song you remember buying from a record shop.
Okay, right. So, as I mentioned earlier, Charlotte and I used to swim in Harlow at a club called Harlow Penguins. And we had a big group of friends there. And one of my friends, Dan Higgs, was also one of my first crushes. I never told him this, though. Weirdly enough, and definitely weirdly, is that my wife, Ro, her mum used to teach him in school in Bishop Stortford. And I remember mentioning that he was my first crush. And she said, oh, yeah, Dan Higgs, lovely boy. Like, definitely.
Confirmation.
Yeah, it wasn't just a crush. It was a common perspective. I went round his. And he was an Arsenal fan as well. Probably still is. We were watching the footy. And then all of a sudden he was like, hey, do you fancy going to the record store and buying a single? I was like, what? Without mum and dad? What? Because usually...
So how old would you have been?
I'm trying to tally. I'd say like 12 or 13.
Right.
And up to that point, like, I would go with mum or dad. Like, I remember trying to buy an Out Here Brothers record. Like, with my thumb covering the explicit lyrics bit. And I was like, oh, can I get this? And my dad peeled my thumb away from the CD cover and was like, no, you can't. But he was absolutely fine playing me AC/DC.
Yeah. You know,
songs about having boners and stuff.
Amazing.
he was like, yeah, let's go to the record store. And I had like, you know, the pocket money that I was given, which was like, I don't know, £5. And I could buy a single with it. So I was looking around and I didn't quite know what to buy. And then I saw... Brimful of Asher by Corner Shop. And I'd heard the Norman Cook remix, but mm-hmm. I didn't know it was a Norman Cook remix.
Right.
So I can't remember what he bought. Like, he must have bought something like, I don't know, a Jamiroquai record or something. It might have been Canned Heat, or was that a bit before?
That would have been a bit after,
yeah,
I think.
Probably a bit after, actually.
Would have been Virtual Reality around that time.
Probably, yeah. We went back to his house, or his parents' house, and we each took turns in putting our CDs on. And I remember being so excited. I was like, oh my God, I bought something that's mine. You know, it was like that first big decision that's yours, you know, when you come out of school and you're like, I have to decide what I've got to do now, you know, with my life. I was like, I can decide what music I can listen to, you know, without mum or dad going, that's good or that's bad. Yeah. I get to choose this now. And he put his CD on and we listened to it. And then I put Brimful of Asher on. And I was like, what's this?
Yeah.
What is this? Like, because it was so slow and it was so chilled. And it was the standard version.
Sure.
It was the Corner Shop version.
Yeah.
And I was like, have I been listening, like, am I going mad? I thought I was going mad. Like,
I reckon 90% of people that bought that
absolutely.
Had that experience.
Yeah, they're like, what's going on?
And as an indie DJ, make sure you click the right track and yeah, don't put that one on the dance floor because it does not work.
Yeah. Otherwise, you'll be like lifted very speeding at 2%. Eventually, I got it because we were flicking through. I was like, oh, right. And... it was at that point that I realised the value and importance of the remix. And I went right through my record collection and I was like, oh my God, this is a remix.
Yeah.
And I knew what mixes were. I started to learn what masters were.
Yeah.
I remember buying like a remastered version of Carpenters and listening to it and going, whoa, God, that's so different. That's so amazing. The record making process was actually a really complicated process, and I loved it all the more for it. because it takes more thought and it's going to take more time. But I, you know, as like a fellow muso, you kind of you revel in that and you swallow it up. And I have a tendency to geek out. So yeah.
Would you always deconstruct music when you heard it?
I don't think I'm trying to look back and think. I mean, when I used to listen to Oasis, maybe when it was when I was trying to work them out on guitar, but when it came to bands like T-Rex, you know, especially the Visconti produced stuff, or like ABBA especially, because even now I listen back and I can't quite believe that they put that stuff down on tape. I mean, it feels supernatural. It's so good.
ABBA.
Yeah, it's so good, it's supernatural.
I've got to say it, Billy, right? Boxing Day, we was in the car driving home from my relatives. My wife said, what should we put on? And I said, for some reason I had ABBA in my head. And I said to her, have you ever heard Angel Eyes by ABBA? And she went, which one's that? And then I went to sing it and she went, don't, because I always sing it badly and no one ever knows it, what I'm talking
always
about.
Always try, though. And it's like, good fun.
And I went, just put it on. I think it's got the greatest chorus ever written.
Right.
And so we put it on and straight away the kids in the back were singing.
Oh, amazing.
And I just thought, it's ingrained, these songs.
Yeah.
These songs find their way. And I've mentioned it before on this podcast, just driving along one day with Aztec Cameras, Somewhere in My Heart, come on the radio.
Yeah.
And my daughter started singing the chorus.
Yeah.
And I was like, how do you know this?
I know.
And
I,
it's like, it's found its way.
Yeah.
And we then just went on this whole journey just listening to ABBA. And arguably, some of the greatest songs ever written.
I know. It's and they produced it all themselves as well. Like, you know.
And so many.
I know. So many. It's like they, in the same way that Motown would just go into a studio and they'd come out with like stone cold hits. But I think one of the first instances of me really going, oh, you know, this is music is worth deconstructing is after learning about the remix. But even that, it's like, I don't think it went far enough. It's when I went to see Mamma Mia, the stage show, and I started reading up on how Benny and Bjorn went about, you know, sort of allocating where the songs went in the show and how the narrative was going to go. And then there was this really interesting story about how they'd never ever written down or notated the songs that they'd written. So they couldn't just hand the notations over to the orchestra or anything like that, or
really?
The conductor. They had to go into the studio and track by track, listen to the performance, and then write out and notate the notes, rhythms, all that sort of stuff. And I thought, what, oh my God. Like, and then you start, you're like, so that's what that mixing desk does. And okay, so those parts in those songs aren't one instrument. They're three instruments blended together. Okay. And you suddenly, the polyphony of music occurs to you.
Yeah.
And the ensemble aspect occurs to you. And that's kind of when you start thinking, I'm going to form a band, you know, because I want to create that polyphony. I want to layer sounds. I want to see what happens. And it really is like, it's kind of like cooking.
Yeah.
You know, you can, I love cooking because, like, firstly, it's just a great way to kind of like go into a meditative transcendent state where you just like menially chopping things up and putting them in bowls and then getting things ready and organizing. But at the same time, it's like you're complementing things and you're setting things off each other. And it's kind of magic. And it's part of that ritualistic ceremonial aspect that makes us what we are. That's kind of like taken us from like cavemen to tribal territorial, communities, dancing around the campfire, screaming at the sky, praying for rain, for the crops to grow. Into like, you know, building cities and connecting those cities and then connecting countries together. Music and food and like art and all that stuff is what is like, it's bound cultures together, and immerse them inside each other and what's like brings us together as like a human species. So yeah, music is a part of that, an integral part of that process. It's, you know, it's forever blows my mind that we can get on a plane, go over to Japan, who, you know, they're a civilization that live untold measures of difference to us. Like the way that they just go about their daily lives, what they eat when they wake up, and, you know, how their school system is run, and how the public transport system, and, you know, the fact that the teenagers are the really good guys, you know, who are straight laced, and it's the businessmen who are acting like teenagers.
Yeah,
it's kind of, you know, you're like, stuff that we made in my bedroom is being played over in Japan in a completely separate and different culture. They're getting to experience our culture. We're getting to go over and experience theirs. So yeah, it's all part of this just magic of existence, I suppose.
You mentioned dancing around and screaming at the sky a moment ago. So that leads us on nicely to track 5.
Yes.
Which is the song that soundtracked your years in Clubland, Billy.
Yes. Okay, so most of my years in Clubland were spent in Harlow, but sometimes it would be in London. But we'd sometimes go to the square, we'd watch a band, and then we'd be like, yeah, we're staying up till 5 in the morning. So we'd go over to Pulse, or Liquid, which is just over the road from the square in the town centre, and it was horrible.
These are your sort of tan-type clubs,
yeah,
playing kind of generic dance music.
Yeah, and then, like, eventually, we started going over to these places so often that one of my mates who ran the square would come over and he'd DJ at Liquid. And every single time, I would go up to him and he'd go, "The Prayer by Block Party," right? I'd be like, yeah, yeah. And for me, that song doesn't just sort of cement in my mind and my memory like that time and those experiences in the club and with a whole new select group of people and friends that I'd made from going to those clubs. It was the experience of being in a club that was completely different to being in a venue, that, you know, where you've got the performers on the stage and the audience plays a participatory role, but largely sort of submissive. Whereas in the club, the DJ is submissive to the whims of the crowd. And I would go up and I'd ask for The Prayer, not just because of like the beat, which was insane. Like Jackknife Lee's production on it is incredible, to the point where when we first went over to America and we started talking to Michael Goldstone, who was heading Warner Records over there, and he asked me about producers. I was like, Jackknife Lee. But it never ended up working out because...
Did you ever hear his band?
No, who's his band?
He was in a band called Compulsion.
Okay, right. Oh,
and,
my God.
Who I first saw supporting the Pumpkins
in
very early
90s. Right, I'm going to have to write this.
And check out the track Mal Monarchy by Compulsion. And
great. I'm just writing that down, sorry.
Yeah, it's a tune, that is.
Wicked. Mal Monarchy, there we go. Sorry, just finished. I hate typing things in. I'm much more of a writer. So it wasn't just like the beat, it wasn't just the production and all this like insane synth line, which I'm still trying to work out to this day. And I'm so tempted to email Jackknife Lee and go, can you just send me the stem of that synth line so I can see what it is? Like, no effects or anything. I just want the dry sound. Mm. I really need to know what that is. It was also the lyrics. And I think Kelly, when he wrote these lyrics, he so perfectly tapped in and deconstructed the mindset of going out and clubbing, right? Which is, as we talked about earlier, like the rave scene, which is communal and people showing love for each other. And you're sort of like, you're involving yourself in something that's bigger than you.
Sure.
You're giving yourself over. You're like dissipating your sense of self so that you become part of this like rhythmic leviathan. Like, you know, this sea of bodies that moves as one to the beat.
Yeah.
But at the same time, like, there is this element that is like, everybody look at me. This night is about me, isn't it? Like, I'm going to shine.
Is this Billy the Show-Off?
Yeah. It so is. And the weird thing is like, well, actually, like, the total appropriate thing is that I would always ask for it as soon as he'd get on the decks, and no one would be on the dance floor.
As a DJ, people like you are the most irritating thing ever. I know what they're going to ask, and they're first up straight away, and you'd be, oh, for fuck's sake.
I know, I understand it, because like, Ro's a DJ, and she's like,
oh, of course, yeah.
And she's like, I'm like, oh, can you play this? No, it doesn't go. It won't work. It will
But it's
work.
All about me,
yeah,
though.
Exactly. That's the point, Steve. So it would just be me. And it was, and obviously, eventually, like, as the night went on, yeah, you'd immerse yourself. You'd become part of that, like, that body of people. And it would just be about the movement and obviously getting absolutely wasted off my tits, which I don't do anymore. But when I was at college, they would have these bops, which were like 4 hours long, and they'd get a DJ in from another college, and you know, people would, they'd play pop hits or whatever, and eventually it'd turn into EDM and some trance hits or whatever. And as the night goes on, it just gets even quirkier. But the beat would be pulsing, just pumping away. And whichever room you were in college, you could hear that beat, and it would always call to me. And even when I wasn't drinking, and probably more so now that I'm not drinking or doing any drugs or anything like that, as soon as I get on the dance floor, I go to somewhere else. Like, I become not me, and I am part of a group that's bigger than me. I feel like I'm tapping into the universe. And Kelly...
Do you get joy out of that?
I get so much joy. I sometimes have to measure my joy, because my come downs from those natural highs...
Really?
Yeah, yeah.
That's really interesting.
It's like, and it happens on stage. Like when I play with the band, and we're of this philosophy where we want to break down that barrier between the band and the fans to an extent where, like, we're giving them a sense of freedom. We're giving them a choice of where the show is going to go. Whilst at the same time still being able to, like, you know, carry on with the show and play. Yeah.
I think you do that well.
Oh, cool. Cheers. Yeah, I mean, like, I just remember being in the audience. I remember hearing my favourite songs being played by, you know, a band on stage and wanting to be a part of it. And you're separated by that huge distance between you and the band, where they're elevated and you're kind of, like, you're liquidated because you're kind of looking up and you feel, I don't know, you almost feel like, I just don't want them to feel like the insignificance I felt at points when I was in the crowd. And that's why I don't like playing shows that are too big.
Yeah.
And if we do play festivals, at least 3 times during the show, I'll be out in the crowd, or I'll be asking them stuff, or I'll be making, you know, I'm just trying to dissipate that huge chasm that exists between us and the crowd. And so... How did I get onto that? The transcendence
that
I experience on stage. Yeah. And so, like, you know, I want to feel like they're possibly feeling in the crowd, and I want them to feel like how I'm possibly feeling on the stage. But also it's like something about playing music with my best friends, the two people that I value probably most in this world, and who I'd die for, Josh and Charlotte. And what we've experienced together over these years, and the songs that we've written together, and the kind of tribulations that we've been through and what we've overcome, which in the grand scheme of things probably isn't much, but personally it feels like we've done a lot. So it's a real kind of, it feels festive. It feels like a circus. It feels like, I don't know, kind of like the dance of death, you know, like we're all living forever in this one moment. And that's kind of like what Kelly talks about in the prayer is like, yeah, the movement. Yeah, we're all dancing to the same beat. Yeah, we're all kind of like going through our daily lives. But when we're on the dance floor, we all become one. But at the same time, like, there's this ego within me that has to, like, what are the lyrics?
Tonight
make me unstoppable. Yeah. I want to slice, I want to charm and dazzle.
Yeah.
So I think this...
The word dazzle don't get used enough anymore.
Does it not? No. Slicing. I remember listening to it and thinking, is he actually saying slicing? I think he is. Mm. But and it kind of like... I love listening to these kinds of songs because it allows me the room to kind of go, I can venture there too. you know. And it's a safe thing to say, you know, I'm only going to go there because others have been there. And that's kind of what, like, Block Party are, is that, like, when they first came out, they just stampeded through every other band at the time and just, you know, planted their flag in the ground with this really kind of dry post-punk sound.
It was someone that was an indie DJ at that point. I got the 7-inch of Banquet, and I was like,
oh my God,
what the fuck is this?
It is like, so beautiful. It's like, yeah, it's an indie hit, but at the same time, it's an incredibly beautiful song.
Yeah.
But they came out with this second record and working with Jackknife Lee, and they'd sort of decided, okay, we could kind of do that again, or we could go synthy, and I love them for it. But I love Kelly even more so because he, in this song, just totally gets clubbing.
Yeah.
For me, anyway.
Wonderful. And I'll tell you what, before we move on to the next track, I'm going to shout out, as the DJ, that if you like that song, check out the Does It Offend You Yeah remix of it. Because
it's
incredible.
I haven't heard that. And I love Does It Offend You Yeah.
Yeah.
Like we played a bunch of festivals with them.
I think, well, it'll be out by the time that this one comes out. But I think the next episode is Bobby from Does It Offend You Yeah's
amazing.
Episode.
Send him my regards because it's been years.
I will do. You need to go and check out what Bobby's doing. He's got a venue called The Rattle. In London now, which he's all put together to, and he's got one in LA now as well. And it's all about getting bands heard and working with new talent and nurturing it. It's amazing.
Brilliant. I'm definitely doing that. Amazing.
But yeah, check that remix out. And I believe Dan Lesac done a good remix of it as well.
Really?
Yeah. Check them out.
I love it. Amazing. Okay, cool. I'm a sucker for a remix now.
Well, I'll tell you what. The Does It Offend You Yeah one is up there with Norman's remix of Corner Shop.
Yeah.
Favourite song from an artist from your home county?
Okay, so I come from Hertfordshire, which is like this liminal space between the urban confines of London and the fens, the rural pastoral perfection of the fens, and it's kind of like it's this in-between space that is limbo, and it was so boring, and that's kind of why I turned to music, because I wanted
can I just say, Billy, that limbo that you talk of there is the reason I set this podcast up.
Oh really?
Because initially I just wanted to speak to people from certain areas,
right,
about where their creativity come from.
Yeah.
And a couple of weeks ago I had Matt from Suede sitting there, and he was saying that they lived outside of London, him and Brett, and nothing happened.
Yeah.
And this comes from the fact that I'm from Essex, where not a lot happens in the world of art and creating music.
Yeah.
And I just wanted to know, especially on the fringes of the areas that we're talking about here, how much pull was there to say, well, you've got to move to London?
It was so weird because when we were playing at the Square, and it was like this fringe venue on the edge of London, which kind of like rendered the idea of going to London negligible unless you wanted to go to like an arena show.
Sure.
Like every gig you wanted to go to was at the Square. But at the same time, it did exist in like this place that's built out of nothing. I mean, Harlow as a new town is like faulty by nature. You know, it was constructed in this ditch. So it's, you know, there are periods of flooding because it's so badly organised. Wellington City in Hatfield, where I grew up, it was a post-war haven for people who were fleeing the Blitz. So, you know, there are these houses that are, you know, these residential areas. There's kind of like a town centre. And it's so central and it's so small that it's almost like a nothing. That it's built for consumption. It's built for time wasting. It's built for money wasting, I suppose. And killing time and little else. You know, we didn't have a cinema in our town. We had more Waitrose than, you know, and Tesco and Asda than anything else. It was this vacuum. And when we started playing more in Welwyn Garden City, and as well as Harlow, because Welwyn Garden City didn't have its square for the several decades beforehand, there was a venue called the Gree Room. I think it's still going, actually, which is above a pub called the Doctor's Tonic. And when that started up, what happened was, on a Thursday nights, there were acoustic sessions, then eventually it went electric, and eventually, like, it became a venue in and of itself. It established itself, not just as a pub, as, like, the only venue in Welwyn Garden City and anywhere near it. But this clique was established, and we've never been very good with cliques. Like, me in school, I was never very good at it. I would sort of hop, skip, jump between groups of people. We as a band were never very good at it. We're never good at collaborations. We'll go on tour with a band, but we'll kind of, like, I think we're just naturally quite insular people, I suppose. I say that being probably one of the most arrogant frontmen I know. But when we were in Welwyn Garden City, there were these cliques that formed, and they were quite exclusionary. And the idea of moving into London was seen as a kind of betrayal of that scene.
It's interesting.
And with the square, it was always seen as a move of advancement, of something that signalled that, you know, you were taking what you'd developed at the square and you were running with it, and they were proud of you for it.
Okay.
So Welwyn Garden City for me represented more of, like, this home counties, curtain twitching, it's almost like residential, suburban, depressive inducing existence that I was avidly fighting against. And one of the reasons why I started the band was because I didn't want to become one of those people. I made that promise, like I said earlier, I made that promise to myself early on. And I'm really proud that I managed to pull that off. But, you know, that was kind of a one in a million chance. And everything, all the disparate elements that made that possible just seemingly came together.
Through hard work.
I look back and I think, yeah, you know, people say, oh, you worked really hard, didn't you? I was like, yeah, but I was also really lucky.
Just because you enjoy what you do, it doesn't mean that it's not hard work.
I know, absolutely. And I look back and I think, wow, what an ambitious kid, you know? And
To have drive is a blessing.
Yeah.
You've got that, you know, to have creativity and drive, that's a force to be reckoned with.
Yeah, and I kind of accept it, but a part of me is like, I want to push that away a little bit and just say, but also I think my parents were incredibly supportive, and we managed to meet up with a bunch of fantastic people at the square and also at the Buffalo Bar in London. Yeah. They were astounding in their support, and that's where we met our manager, Ben. We were two songs in and he ran up and he went, stop, do you have a manager? And we're like, no. Can I be your manager? If you let us get on with the show, yes.
Oh, the middle of a gig?
Yeah, in the middle of a gig.
Love that.
So, yeah, you know, I reluctantly take that point. Yeah, I was ambitious and all that sort of stuff. But I think we were really lucky and we got in with a great group of people. And also, you know, I was lucky in that I had Josh and Charlotte on my side the whole time as well. And they stuck by me even through my most difficult times. But The whole idea of the band was just to create something out of nothing, to turn away from the vacuum that could have been and make something out of nothing and just be something, define myself as a creator, I suppose. But there are some bands that Hertfordshire is not all the same. Mm-hmm. You know, Welwyn Garden City, I love and hate it and resent it. And I'm constantly telling my parents to move out of there because they'd be happier because of the nature of daily life there. And I don't want to disparage the town too much because I love it for all its faults. Mm. I grew up there and it's a part of me.
Of course.
You know, the kind of like the mediocrity of like just, I don't know, the town itself, which is simply just like, you know, estates and a town centre, has in itself like a kind of beauty and profundity that I don't want to diminish with like the words that I've been saying, you know. It's made me who I am. But there are places like St. Albans, where one of my all-time favourite bands come from, The Zombies.
Okay. They've got a venue, haven't they? The Horn?
The Horn, which has existed for decades now and has always been an absolutely beautiful and brilliant place to play.
Am I right in saying that the Shikari's from there?
They are. Yeah. They are. And I think that has something to do with like The Horn being there. Luke Hinton, who runs it now, and he started branching out in other areas in Hertfordshire, notably, I think it might also be called The Horn in Bishop Stortford.
Right, okay.
But they're not joined up. He just happened to take charge of the back room there. And Bishop Stortford's another place where it's just kind of like, you know, it's ethereal. It's nothing really happens.
Yeah.
And that's where Ro grew up when she moved down from Redditch or in Birmingham. And The Zombies grew up in St. Albans, which is totally different to Wellington City in that it's an historic town. It's got like a booming economy. It's filled with private schools. There is so much to do. And it's even like my mum tried to get me into a state school there, couldn't get me in. And that's why I ended up going to Hertford. I've got some good friends who live there. And I can see why Enter Shikari came from it, and I can see why The Zombies came from it. And I think The Bush Tree and Me come from there as well.
Oh, my God, I've not heard of that band for a long time.
Yeah, I know. They used to play in Welling Garden City as well.
Oh.
Do you remember Smash? Do you know Smash?
Of course. Right. Smash and These Animal City. Men.
Welling Garden City.
Right. Have you watched the Smash documentary on Amazon Prime?
Is it good?
Oh, my God, yes.
I bet some of my best mates are in it.
Oh, watch it. It's incredible.
Yeah. When we got our first headline gig at the Garage in Islington, in Highbury, we got Smash to support us. We were like, come on, let's do this together. Welling Garden City.
Amazing.
Yeah. Eddie Argos from...
Art Brute
came along. And we're taking Art Brute out on tour.
I saw that.
This year. Yeah.
Incredible.
Yeah, so it's so funny how things work out. It's just... I love this. I love being part of this. This is kind of like... The Zombies bring up a really kind of specific time in my life, because there was a period when... Did you ever like use LimeWire?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, yeah. So like the peer-to-peer networks, when that started, I was like fucking straight on it. And as much as I'm kind of like, I'm conflicted, like, you know,
of course,
record sales and all that sort of stuff. What LimeWire did for me was it threw open the doors, and I was bathed in music, in so much music. And I stumbled across The Zombies on LimeWire, and I managed to download all their stuff. And I would just listen to them over and over and over. When I was talking to people on MSN Messenger, and there was a period during my school times and kind of just about to go into working life when I was trying to balance that anxiety about going from the hyperstructure of being in school life and then kind of having the band,
sure,
and then going into like getting a job, and then, you know, my mum was badgering me about getting on the council house waiting list, and
yeah,
and I just wanted to plug in. I wanted to plug into the computer. I wanted to talk to my friends, and I wanted to listen to The Zombies. And She's Not There is like that song that took me to a place where I could just zen. You know,
it's a cracker, isn't
it? Oh my God! And again, it's a, you know, it's a love song about unrequited. It's about absence, in the same way that Smokey Robinson's songs are about absence,
And all the Subway songs we've now.
Absolutely, yeah. I'm so predictable. Like, one thing that's so predictable about me is that I won't know so much about my patterns of behaviour. My wife will turn around and go, oh, so that's why you do that. And I'm like, fucking hell, yeah, it is, isn't it?
Well, speaking of your wife, who's a lovely human being and a great DJ.
Oh, thank
it's
you.
It's your turn to play DJ. So this is the last track, and it's your turn to turn someone on to a bit of music that you think they probably may not have heard.
Okay, well, I mentioned earlier how much Ro's show has done for me. I'm a co-host on her show. Basically, it's Riot Diet on Boogaloo Radio, and what she does is she only plays acts featuring at least one female or trans member. And what it's done to me is it has completely shaken my perspective of my place in the music industry. And it's completely opened up all the different kinds of music that I otherwise would never have heard. And, you know, that's partly down to my own ignorance, my own tendency to play certain bands on loop forever and ever, amen. But going on that show for 2 hours, listening to new releases by women in music and trans members in music has totally, I'm speaking completely selfishly here, changed the way that this next album by The Subways is going to be. It's proven such an inspiration. But more than anything, it's made me realise my own privilege, my own place in the music industry, and it's liberated me in thinking that it is such a great thing to be able to step back and provide a platform for those who are most disenfranchised and marginalised in the music community, those who are most ignored. And I've made so many friends because of it. And we're talking, I'm already like on Twitter and Instagram, I'm talking with bands about taking them on tour. And you know, bringing those bands to our fans over in Europe and over in America. Speaking specifically about one song that I think everybody should hear now that I'm the DJ for once, it's a song called OMG, I'm All Over It by Jen Champion. And Ro played me this song on her show, or she just played it, and I, as the co-host, you know, in between, as the music's playing, we'll have a chat, and I just had to shut the fuck up and listen to this song, because it was I've never really been like a spiritual or religious person. Like, maybe over the last couple of years I've kind of conceded to the fact that there's something supernatural, maybe that our language or our understanding of this world can't quite explain. And music like Jen Champion's, which is like, it's 3 minutes and they're pop melodies, but there is something sparkling and supernatural and something so ineffably beautiful happening in between the notes and in between the words spoken and in between the beats. And I have been obsessively playing her record, Single Rider, since that moment. It got me through my third year at uni. My God, like getting me through exams at Cambridge was quite the feat. But anytime I would think that I was about to collapse, I put Single Rider on and it would get me through, because I feel like there's some kind of like life-giving energy in her music. And she's like, a lesbian, part of a music scene that's happening over in Seattle at the moment that is, I think, going to change the face of music forever. And I can't wait for a second record. But this song, OMG, I'm All Over It, it's for everybody. And it's magic. It's pure magic. And I hope you like it.
You sold that very well, Billy. So, The Subways, what's happening?
Right, so we are recording our fifth album right now. I'm engineering and producing, which is great for me, but you know, I'm a complete control freak. I have to be in control of everything, but I'm learning. So I'm handing the mixes over to Adrian Bushby, who's worked with Muse and Foo Fighters, worked with Spice Girls and Kylie, I found
wonderful.
Out. Yeah. He sent a mix to us the other day, which I'm bowled over by, and I played the mix to Charlotte and she cried. I played the mix to Josh, who is impossible to please, you know, a drummer, no less, with Asperger's syndrome. He absolutely is fully on board. So, yeah, we've got two mixes to come back, and I'm currently editing Josh's and Charlotte's performances and about to record guitars and vocals. And the record should be out later this year or early next year. We've got a new single for which we're shooting the video very soon, but that'll be out in the summer, I reckon. But it's all very exciting, and I'm kind of getting head rushed just thinking about it.
Live stuff?
Live stuff. We're playing an anniversary tour. It's 15 years since the release of Young for Eternity, our debut record, and we're touring the UK and Europe.
How did the Subways come out 15 fucking years ago?
I know. It's so weird. I like look in the mirror, I'm like,
Subways,
what's
you've only
happened?
Been about, mate? 8 years ago?
Yeah, I know. 15 years. So yeah, it's been a magical journey, and I want it to continue. And yeah, we're so excited about these UK shows. We did really well over in Europe, and we did really well over in America, strangely enough, in Russia, which is amazing because it's such a fascinating place to be. So yeah, it's going to be great to be playing in the UK, to be playing UK venues and playing to UK crowds, because I feel like we have neglected our beautiful people of the UK for too long now. So yeah, we're going to be playing the first album in full, and we're going to be supported by the magnificent Art Group, who I am, when we booked them, I was just like, they were my first choice. A part of me was like, then they're going to say it's not really for them, or they're going to be unavailable. And I personally didn't think the tour was going to be possible without them.
Yeah.
So I'm so glad that they said yes, and I'm so fucking excited.
Excellent. So, yeah. Where can people find out all about this, Billy?
Well, you can go to thesubways.net, or you can find us on Facebook, The Subways, on Twitter, at The Subways, Instagram, at The Subways. Or you can follow me, Billy Lunn, on Instagram, Billy Subway on Twitter, Charlotte Subway on Twitter. Yeah, we're everywhere. We're, you know, you'll find us.
Well, I'll tag you in everything when we put this out.
You're legend.
And all I can say is thank you so much, Billy. It's been a joy.
Thank you for having me, and I'm sorry it took so long.
it was so much fun. It really was. Billy's, as you can tell, full of energy. He's smart. You know, he's kind. And he's a straight up rock star. It was a great chat. And yeah, try and get along to one of those Subway shows and keep your eyes peeled for the new album. I think that's me done. As I said at the beginning, thanks again for listening and all your support. Really appreciate it. Anything you see on the socials, give it a like, a love, a share, a retweet and all of that stuff. And better still, please subscribe. And yeah, go and have a look in the back catalogue because there's bundles of greatness there. Have a smashing week and I'll see you next time. See you later. Bye-bye. Oh yeah, sorry, I've butted in yet again. I just want to quickly tell you about this magazine. It's called Pod Bible. Now, Pod Bible is the new essential guide to podcasts. It's put together alongside Spotify and Acast, and it's a one-stop shop to tell you all about the podcasts you maybe know about, but definitely about a load of the podcasts that you probably don't know about that we think you should know about. I mean, in the first edition, there's interviews with Adam Buxton, interviews with Craig Parkinson, there's features on Jade Adams, and there's just an abundance of information about so many exciting podcasts that are out there. Also, Spotify have given us these amazing little codes, so if you do get a print copy, you can just turn on your Spotify on your phone, scan the little code, and it just automatically opens up the podcast on your listening device. How good's that? If you haven't managed to get a print copy, then just go over to www.podbiblemag.com and read it online, because the digital version is all over there and it's all free. So every other month there'll be a new edition out. So go and have a look and support us on the social medias as well, podbiblemag.com. It's Off the Beaten Track Podcast on the Distraction Pieces Network. Me, Stew Whiffin.
Eat Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.